Chers auditeurs, chères auditrices, bienvenue à Radio Créum et à la balado-diffusion du colloque en mémoire de Jerry Cohen qui a eu lieu à l'Université McGill le 27 novembre 2009. Dear listeners, welcome to Radio Créum and to the podcast of the conference in memoriam of Jerry Cohen that took place at McGill University on November 27, 2009.
Okay, I think we'll move on to Jacob's paper, Jacob's presentation. I'm not supposed to call these things papers, right? In the spirit of the event. So Jacob, on to you.
I'm going to reflect on passages from a few different parts of Cohen. Begin by saying that I never met Cohen personally. I had very occasional intermittent email contact with him, including most recently conversation that we were getting started with about resuming his old practice of coming to McGill once every few years to teach a graduate seminar, something that obviously I'm very disappointed we weren't able to bring to fruition anything like enough time. Therefore, like Will, I know primarily G.A. Cohen the author, not Jerry Cohen the man. Unlike Will, I think that I'm at significant arm's length from every part of G.A. Cohen, the author's projects. The following quote is reported, has been attributed to Cohen, I think, by Tom Brooks. He described his intellectual life up until the time of the quote as having consisted of, quote, three long-running arguments over the course of my career. The first was with the Althusserians on Marx's theory of history, and I knew what that was about. The second was with Nozick on self-ownership, and I knew what that was about. The third was with Dworkin on expensive tastes, and I still have no idea what that was about. Now, it steps on the punchline to say, subsequent to the quote, he, of course, engaged in a fourth long-running conversation with Rawls and Rawlsians on the difference principle. Now, Will, I take it, is at least to a certain degree an Althusserian, and I am not really any of those camps of people with whom Cohen was having a conversation, and therefore there's a degree to which I've come to Cohen's corpus in the last year or so as a neophyte and someone who doesn't think that I have a great deal of stake in the outcome of lots of the conversations that are going on. Though I will say that reading Justice and Equality made me feel more like a Rawlsian than I think I had ever felt before in my career.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yes. Now, that long-running conversation structure of his intellectual career that might call to mind, for example, the career of his, I take it, friend and contemporary, Brian Berry, but with, I think, an important difference. Lots of people entered into these conversations with Cohen with a sense that there was something frustrating, something difficult if you were on the other side of the conversation, and yet with a sense of really significant long-term reward. And I think the sensibility that Will offered from his perspective about the work on Marx is something that we see over and over again in the way that people in those groups have responded. The book on self-ownership, it's a very odd book in lots of ways, but it's also in lots of ways one of the very best books and maybe the best book on Nozick and on Nozickian philosophy. Rescuing Justice and Equality is, to my mind, a very difficult and frustrating and, as I will say over the course of my presentation, very substantially wrong book. It's also clearly the best book in Rawlsian political philosophy or on Rawlsian political philosophy in a very, very long time. It's an important, rewarding thing. And while people sometimes said that Cohen was missing the point of one or another view he was engaging with, I do not think that they ordinarily said, as people usually said when they were on the wrong end of Brian Berry's engagement, that he was being systematically unfair or misrepresentative. Now, often Berry could get lots of intellectual traction out of the unfairness or the misrepresentation, and Cohen would sometimes get lots of intellectual traction out of what others would take to be his missing of the point. But there's something more rewarding about engaging with Cohen and seeing his conversations. And so nothing that I have to say subsequent should detract from that sense, that I've learned a great deal, even as an outsider and a neophyte, from the engagement. In an unpublished paper that's circulating online on conservatism, Jerry Cohen says the following. Philosophers like me are not primarily, as philosophers, interested in what should be done in practice, all things considered. We are interested instead in what distinct things are worth considering. We care more about what ingredients should go into the cake than about the proportions in which they are to be combined. If there is a difference between political theory and political philosophy, this is still Cohen, then what you are going to hear is mostly political philosophy. If there is something called political theory that some people prefer to political philosophy, then those who are partisans of political theory, thus contrasted, are people who characteristically care more than their philosophical cousins do about the all things considered answer, which tells you what to do. And sometimes they even care about the answer which tells you what to do here and now. Many political theorists are professionally interested in whether or not we should introduce proportional representation or move to a greater use of judicial review. Philosophers aren't so interested in such questions, except insofar as they are citizens, which most of them are, albeit in some cases reluctantly. Philosophers don't think there's anything special about either the here or the now, and they're not professionally interested in what should be done, all things considered. As someone who is, as it were, professionally committed to political theory, I read this passage as an invitation for an easy way out for my frustrations and difficulties with the work of Jerry Cohen, which is simply to say, well, I am a political theorist, and I am engaged in different kinds of things, and what he has told me is that the task of political philosophy isn't like that. I'm going to talk about why I'm not going to take that easy way out, and to insist there's still something off about the way in which he's trying to encourage us to think about the task of political philosophy itself. And for that, I will turn to, as we're calling them, the big book and the small book, Rescuing Justice and Equality and On Socialism. In On Socialism, Cohen insists that, quote, socialists face two questions which are not often treated as distinctly as they should be. The first is, would socialism, if feasible, be desirable? The second is socialism feasible? To take the contrast that we just encountered, I guess that Cohen would say that is socialism feasible might be a question that political theorists could have something to say about, but is a question that he thinks is strictly irrelevant to the first question. Would socialism, if feasible, be desirable? And that, I take it, is something closer to what he takes to be the task of political philosophers to identify. That distinction, the sense that there is an articulation of the normatively attractive principles that is untainted by considerations of feasibility. That is, as we've already heard some reference to, an important theme in the big book. It's never stated, I think, quite so nicely and sharply as it is in that moment in On Socialism. But the idea that, as it were, justice might not be feasible, but its infeasibility is irrelevant to the question of the meaning of justice. That is a really central claim of the bulk of part two of Rescuing Justice and Equality. And he spells it out in somewhat longer language that's been alluded to. He says, for Rawlsian constructivism, here being just one example of the kind of view he's targeting, fundamental principles of justice reflect facts. Rawls believes that because he misidentifies the question, what is justice, with the question, what principles should we adopt to regulate our affairs? For facts undoubtedly help to decide what rules of regulation should be adopted, if only because facts constrain possibilities of implementation. And then taking on one further target, and soon I will switch out of Cohen's voice into my own. Josh Cohen infers, quote, that we do not need to have principles of justice that address, end quote, circumstances that will not, in fact, obtain. So, for example, he continues, we need not have anything definite to say about what we would do if the satisfaction of the difference principle led to great inequality, because Cohen thinks that, in fact, the difference principle does not sanction great inequality. Now, indeed, is it true that to decide what we need to do, notice again that emphasis, it is indeed true that to decide what to do, we need to say nothing definite, in fact, nothing at all, about that counterfactual state of affairs. But suppose that, like me, Cohen, you think that political philosophy is a branch of philosophy, whose output is consequential for practice, but is not limited in significance to its consequences for practice. Then you may, as I would, protest that the question for political philosophy is not what we should do, but what we should think, even when what we should think makes no practical difference. Over the course of those passages, Cohen lays out a task for political philosophy that is the identification of what justice means, or in one case, the question whether socialism is desirable, but he ultimately is to reach the conclusion that there is an equation between those two. What justice means that is untainted by considerations of facts in the world, and he elevates that to a methodological stance in part two of Rescuing, the methodological stance that principles are, as he puts it, fact independent. That when you've actually identified a principle, it must not be something that is conditional or contingent on facts in the world, and it must not make reference in its content to any empirical ephemera. Very importantly and conspicuously, and in a way I think more fundamental than the engagement just with Rawls, he includes in this the Humean circumstances of justice. It cannot be the case to articulate what justice means that we make any reference to, for example, the fact that we live in a world of material finitude. First, we articulate justice. And if it turns out that in a world of material finitude, justice is infeasible, well, so much the worse for our sadly fallen world. Maybe in order to know what to do in our sadly fallen world, we need rules of regulation that take account of material finitude. But then let us not call what we do justice. As I said, I want to avoid taking the easy path of saying, well, Cohen has defined political philosophy thereby, and he's just defined a task that I have no interest in, and I, as a fallen political theorist, will set about trying to decide what it is that is to be done. I think it's a misdescription of the task of political philosophy in the first instance, not least because it is a misdescription of what the concept of justice refers to. Cohen never notes this. I don't know whether he would have known it or cared, but it seems to me that there's something very Greek about the isomorphism Cohen proposes between justice in social relations and a kind of just or fair morality in all of human affairs. But since Rome, and certainly since the modern school of natural jurisprudence, beginning no later than with Grotius, which includes all of social contract theory, but not only social contract theory, that has not been the dominant way of thinking about what justice as a virtue, as a part of morality, means. Justice from use, justice from an idea of law and lawfulness. Justice is, as it were, a Roman word, not a Greek word. Justice is the part of morality, A, that is rule-like and law-like in its structure. That is to say, it is concerned with thresholds and duties and rights, not with maximizings and virtues that can always seek to be perfected further. So A, the part of morality that is law-like and rule-like, and B, the part of morality that is concerned with the social institutions of laws and rules. What Cohen takes to be this weird quirk of Rawls, that Rawls is interested in rules of regulation and for some reason calls that justice, that, to my eye, is, well, that's what justice is. That might not be the whole of morality. It might not be the whole of ethics. But insofar as justice picks out a distinct sphere, a distinct part of the moral world, that has always been what it was. And Rawls as a social contractarian is just the latest iteration of something in the modern school of natural jurisprudence and social contract theory that has taken that as a view about the need for a sphere of morality that did that work all along. This, by the way, is, I think, one curious effect of the long-running conversations model. And it's something that showed up in the book on Rawls and the book on Nozick, and if I understand Will correctly, in a way it showed up in the book on Marx as well. Traditions that generate in their latest versions, the versions that Cohen happens to encounter, some interesting outgrowth of a theory. Cohen had a tendency to take that interesting outgrowth as being the whole of what the theory was about. It seems to me that, for example, in the Nozick case, the institution of ownership in the world as a rule of regulation for allowing humans to coexist peacefully, that comes first. Locke a little bit, and then Nozick really radically, takes the social relation that is ownership and builds into it a metaphorical extension into the way that an agent interacts with his or her own body, that is self-ownership. And Cohen then plucks off self-ownership as if it's a freestanding doctrine and theory and runs with it and sees what he can do with it. And it's a fascinating intellectual exercise. But it's not clear to me that it tells us much that is really very deep about the underlying institution that generated the metaphor in the first place. Much the same is true for the difference principle as being the distributive justice part of justice. Rawls does not claim that the difference principle or the distributive justice, social justice, distributional outcomes that he's concerned with are the whole of justice. He says rather that the way that the natural jurisprudence and social contract schools have always talked about and tried to learn about justice, the rules of regulation that allow us to lead our lives in morally appropriate ways, would, if we take them seriously, also generate a rule constraining material inequality. But the rule constraining material inequality comes at the end of the whole process. Cohen grabs it as if it is going to then replace everything that has come before. Political philosophers are, I believe, deeply concerned with what justice demands, what justice entails. And here I do mean to say political philosophers, the group of people whom I learn from and admire, but I'm not myself a part of as a political theorist. And political philosophers are concerned with ideal theories of justice. Again, that's something that I'm at arm's length from because I'm not an ideal theorist. But even an ideal theory of justice, even a philosophical approach to justice, is still an attempt to articulate rules for the coexistence of beings like us in circumstances kind of like ours. That doesn't mean that any particular set of circumstances, even Hume's, gets accorded an unquestionable status. We have to be willing to argue about which circumstances are going to be built in. We have to, in other words, be willing to think about which facts are relevant to the articulation of what rule-like morality will allow us to live together in a morally rule-like fashion. But that doesn't mean that we should take some one outgrowth of that thought experiment to then replace all of the stuff that justice was all along. Cohen, it seems to me, has extended the Rawlsian thought experiment in a fascinating way. And it's a way that does tell us a great deal about Rawls's latest iteration of thinking about justice. For example, to mention something that Daniel brought up, I think that Cohen has really the best treatment in the literature about this problem about whether the family is part of the basic structure. It's something that's off to the side, it's not central to Cohen's concerns, but it's something that Rawlsianism got deeply tied up and confused about, and Cohen comes in with just an excellent pair of philosophical scissors and says, now, here is where the issue actually is, here's where the problem is, and therefore exposes a deep problem, a real problem in Rawls's theory. But showing the problem in Rawls's theory is not the same as rebuilding a conception of what justice is. To conclude, I want to come back around to the conservatism essay with which I began. Cohen there distinguishes between the political philosopher and the political theorist on grounds that the political theorist is the one who's going to be concerned with saying what we should do, all things considered, and might be interested in boring institutional questions like proportional representation. There is, however, another way of glossing the difference between political philosophy and political theory. And it's one in which, in that essay, in the conservatism essay, but not in most of his writings, Cohen approaches the political theory side of doing things. He says, in the way he lines out the distinction there, that he's not going to tell us a recipe, he's only going to be interested in one of the ingredients. But to take one of the ingredients, in the case of the conservatism essay, the moral duty to cherish that which already exists and has value, the moral duty to value that which is and is valuable, which he does not say is going to issue in recommendations about what to do, but is just a thing about our moral lives that he wishes to take out, examine, show to us from a number of different perspectives. As Joe Cairns once said about Michael Walzer, to take something out and point to it and say, isn't it like this? Rather than write a roadmap of things that ought to be done. That, strikingly, is something that we ordinarily see among the great practitioners of political theory, among whom I would count, for example, Michael Walzer, George Kateb, Sheldon Wohl, and Judith Schlar. In, however, the books like Rescuing Justice and Equality, while there is not a what is to be done conclusion, there is a totalizing flavor to the system. From one idea, Cohen will build up a full account of what justice means and what morally considered can be allowed to go into our calculations about something like material inequality. There is not room left, I think, in the totalizing system, Cohen, of rescuing, for there to be other quirky things about morality and about our moral lives that one might take out and point at and say, isn't it like this? The Cohen of the conservatism essay seems systematically excluded. He's aware of this, and he says simply, well, justice comes first, and everything I have to say here only gets purchase insofar as justice already exists in the background, or at least insofar as the thing that is being valued does not contribute to injustice. But as a methodological stance, there is something to be said, even having set out the task of ideal political philosophy, as I hope, correctly. There's something to be said for the mood of the political theorist that he expresses in the conservatism essay, of saying, I might not know where to put this into the system, but there's a complexity here, an ingredient to focus on. And so in drawing the distinction in a way that says the political theorist will be the one who gives you the complete recipe, he gets things, I think, precisely backwards.
Thank you, Jacob. Peter?
In the beginning of what you said, Jacob, you said that engaging with Cohen made you feel more Rawlsian than you ever expected. Now, there's one sense in which that puzzles me, and here's why. So you make this distinction between, or Cohen makes this distinction between what we should think versus what we should do. Right? And my question to you is one to an arm's length observer of ideal theory, and Rawls is an ideal theorist. Now, within that distinction between what we should think versus what we should do, it strikes me as if I would place Rawls on the what we should think side with his ideal theory rather than what we should do side. So at least in that sense, engaging with Cohen can't make you feel more Rawlsian. And I was trying to put those two pieces together. So maybe either you can explain how you feel more Rawlsian, but not in that respect, or how you think that the ideal theory that we find in Rawls actually helps us to answer the question what we should do.
Rawls is engaged in asking the question, what should we think about what we should do? Which is something that Cohen's formulation, I think, deliberately doesn't leave space for. He thinks that we can engage in something like conceptual analysis of what justice is, even if it turns out to have no practical payoff, that it could be something like what math would be even if we had never discovered engineering. And this seems to me to misidentify what our political concepts of morality are like. Whereas, and here's the sense in which I found myself identifying with Rawls in at least some limited fashion, whereas I think Rawls has more correctly understood the task. How shall we think about what it is we should do? The way that Cohen targets that enterprise, that's what makes me identify with Rawls and say, well, I have many, many arguments with the way Rawls proceeds and with the way Rawls builds the ideal non-ideal distinction. I think that Cohen might successfully put fatal pressure on Rawls's attempt to have it both ways, to have the Humean circumstances and still say there's a categorical difference between the ideal theory he's engaged in and the non-ideal theory that people like me are engaged in. But the solution to that, from my perspective, is not Cohen's. It is not to wipe all consideration of circumstances away. It is rather to try to do the kind of thing that Rawls was trying to do, take seriously some of the circumstances and worry about which circumstances get admitted when, and just admit that Rawlsian theory is then one version of a continuum of ways of thinking about justice rather than being categorically different than those that admit other circumstances that he calls non-ideal. Did that get there? Okay.
If I can recast Jerry's distinction in a way I think might be closer to what was motivating him to draw the distinction, then my question, once I've done it, would be, do you think the distinction is fallacious, or do you think it's just not that important? So the distinction would simply be between things we do think, a spelling out of our intuitions and capturing them in general principles, and the application of the application of facts to those intuitions to think new things that we don't already think but should think in the new circumstances. Do you think that's not a real distinction, or do you think it's just not an important one?
I can't see it. How is it that we get to the concept of justice that Cohen is going to only then at a later stage admit into conversation with facts? Well, in the socialism book, we partly get there by an inquiry about that which we would find morally appealing and morally psychologically attractive about living in one way rather than another in a thought experiment, a camping trip. That is, what is it like for people like us to relate to other people like us, given the moral psychologies that we all already know that we have? You called it an intuition. In On Socialism, it's an intuition. In Rescuing, that word is very hard to come by. Because after all, intuitions are just facts about us. And they're facts about us that have been built up because we are beings that live in a world that happens to be the world that we live in. They are not our Kantian ability to intuit the truths of math. They are something much more mundane and worldly. Now, if we admit the intuitions at the earliest stage and then try to abstract them and say, here's what those intuitions amount to, and therefore, here's what the moral concept is that we are grappling our way towards. I do think there can be a moment in a back and forth theorizing for that abstraction. Here, by the way, is another moment that I'm going to start to sound vastly more Rawlsian than I've ever thought of myself. This is, after all, reflective equilibrium. Our core intuitions in reflective equilibrium, slavery is wrong and I don't need to think too many thoughts to get there. Well, we know that because we live in a non-ideal world where we have histories and we know something about what slavery is. In Rescuing, however, the concept seems to be radically detached from anything like that. I don't know how it is he thinks we get there. I don't know where it comes from. If it comes from those moral intuitions, if it comes from a building up and a generalizing and an abstracting from something like the thought experiment in socialism, then it has to be the case that there's room for there to be other things that get admitted at that stage. It could be that there is an understanding of justice that is the moral abstraction of the thought experiment of the camping trip. But that doesn't tell us that the thought experiment of the camping trip is the uniquely true and relevant thing to getting us a theory of justice. It could be that there are other thought experiments about other moments in human life that tell us other things. And so I think that all we are ever going to have is a back and forth, not a strict sequencing between get the concept and then test against the facts.
Joe is on.
So I thought it was very, very interesting, Jacob, but I wondered how you connected that that story you're telling of Cohen, which makes him a very abstract philosophical thinker, with the stuff that he says in the beginning where he's contrasting his own approach to Rawls and saying he's an intuitionist. Remember this stuff at the very beginning where he's saying, A, he's an intuitionist and the Rawlsians are against that, and also he's a kind of pluralist and somebody who's not interested in getting more precision than is kind of quasi-Aristotelian, you know, don't look for more precision than is possible in this kind of subject matter. And so we don't know exactly how far the duty goes, but we don't have trouble figuring out what restaurant to go to or, you know, so on, what wine to buy. So why is that a problem? So there he sounds much more kind of, it doesn't fit with this picture that you've given us.
You're right, and I know that I don't have an answer. I am baffled by the relationship between that self-identification methodologically at the beginning and what I see especially in part two of the book. If he's up to the kind of thing that he tells us he's going to be up to in the introduction, I don't see its effect. Now, maybe that means I'm engaged in a really radical misreading. Maybe it means that he really does think that the intuitions, say the intuitions that we get from the camping trip thought experiment, do generalize into something that is abstract and pure, can be purified from taint, from the impure way that we had to discover it, which was this thought experiment about intuitions, and that once we get to it, it is philosophical, properly speaking.
So what if you dropped part two of Cohen? What do you lose?
Part two of the book.
Of the book. You know, does any of your critique affect any of what he says in part, which personally, I'm much more drawn to the part one than part two. The other stuff's thing, who cares? I want to know what the cash value is of this whole debate about justice and whether it is pure.
It depends on whether we read part one as being an indictment of difference principle reasoning or an indictment of calling the outcome of difference principle reasoning just. I think that the second one is, in a backwards way, grounded in part two. It's grounded in the story that what it is to have a principle must be purity in this sense. As we already heard this morning, there are moments even in part one when Cohen says, well, even if X and Y and Z all turn out to be true, let's not call it justice. If you drop part two, then that claim looks really weird and free-floating.
I thought it's a weird claim anyway.
But I think it's a claim that he's deeply committed to, and I think that it animates more of part one than maybe you do.
Okay, so the way I understand it, a big part of the argumentative line of what you said today is kind of a critique of Cohen's distinction between the methodology of political philosophy and political theory. And so you tried to, among other things, to show that it was not that clear, and you cannot easily do one of them without doing the other. So, So if you don't really agree with the distinction he makes in this paper about conservatism, how could you frame or explain a more satisfactory distinction between the methodology of these two? So could you formulate a more appropriate distinction between the methodology of political philosophy and political theory? Is that clear?
Yeah. Yes.
All right.
First, I want to thank you for the presentation, all of you, for this morning, because I didn't know Cohen, and now I have idea of his work and etc. And I want to read it, and so thanks for that. I have another question, and since the beginning of the meeting, I'm wondering myself what is the impact of his work and to which population is it directed. I can understand the context in which Marx wrote and the space in the population for the reception of this idea, and it's the same for words. So your presentation make a point, and the distinction between political philosophy and political theory, and I don't know, apparently Cohen is in more in political philosophy and is thinking about what it means, but actually it really hurts my intuition, because how can you think about political philosophy without thinking about its implication in public policy and in the population? So I don't know, that's one comment. Another comment is, if we think like me, what is the place in the North American society for this kind of thought? Because, you know, it's like a culture of revolution, of social struggle and emancipation. So I have a question about the impact of his work, because I think you can't think just for this kind of topic, just for intellectual, you know? So, yes, it's a general question, but I don't know if it's clear, actually.
I'm afraid I didn't follow it.
Okay. So there is two comments. A first comment in the distinction between political philosophy and political theory, and how can you think in political philosophy without thinking about the implication in the public policy of what you are thinking? So it's a first comment. And according to that, I want to know what is the impact on the population of Cohen's work. You know, is there some space for a reception of his work in the North American society?
On the second, I have no view. I don't know what it would be to have a view. The transmission belt from work in any branch of the academy into political action and reception by the public, that's a field unto itself that I've got nothing to say about. Then I think I'm going to lump the first part with the other. I don't think it's the case that the distinction between political theory and political philosophy is a false distinction. I do think it's the case that there is a separate role for thinking about the rule-like part of morality governing our social lives in ways that is more strongly dependent on moral philosophy, meta-ethics, philosophy of language, and a place for doing that kind of thing in a way that is more dependent on knowledge of social science, knowledge of history, for example. That even when they have the same subject matter, their recourse to intellectual resources from the two different home disciplines marks them out as importantly different. I also offered in my final version, in the final couple moments, something like an observation about the different way that political theorists and political philosophers operate, that also leaves something important that is done by each. Political philosophers, as an observed matter, and this is just a fact about what I see in the intellectual world, political philosophers as an observed matter will try to do more with less. They will try to go from relatively austere premises to relatively complete systems of thought. Again, always, it is thought about what it is we should do, because that's what thinking about political philosophy is, but nonetheless, relatively complete and far-reaching systems of thought. Whereas political theorists are often happier with taking some thick thing in isolation about our morality, our intuitions, the facts about the world we live in, and thinking about it in a normative way that might or might not lead to a whole system built from it, but rather just saying, as Cohen says in the conservatism essay, well, here's what it would be to do this part. Here's what it would be to cherish the value of a valuable institution without knowing, all things considered, what the whole system of political morality into which that had to fit would be. Now, to bring it back to your way of putting the question, that does mean that political philosophy, in both ways that I phrased the distinction, is concerned with politics. It is concerned with the social world. Whether it's because it's engaged in trying to understand at a fairly high level of ideal abstraction what the rules of regulation, as Cohen dismissively calls them, should be, or because it's trying to think about them together in a way that integrates and system builds rather than piecemeal and in isolation from multiple different angles, the way that political theory does. Its subject matter is always what it is that should be done so that people like us can live together in relatively morally decent circumstances. So I don't think that it can be done in a way that is completely detached. But that it can't be done in a way that is completely detached doesn't mean that there's not a separate valuable enterprise there. It's just, I think, a more valuable enterprise to the degree that it is not quite so detached as Cohen seems programmatically committed to, even though he doesn't always practice it that way.